listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Hello and welcome to Football in Europe with me, Rob Daly. This is your weekly European football podcast. Alongside me is Chris Parrott. Chris, what are we talking about this week?
Champions again, Rob. Benfica celebrate their latest win with a moped in their dressing room. We speak to Richard Connolly, commentator for the Eredivisie on Sky Sports, about Dirk Kuyt's hat-trick to win final the title. BT Sport commentator Adam Summerton breaks down why Inter Milan are such a mess at the moment. Monaco are on the brink of the Ligue 1 title in France. And I'll tell you about Atleti's new stadium.
Yeah, Chris, you got inside access to the brand new Atleti stadium.
Yeah, on a boiling hot Madrid day. It's mighty impressive. It's a world away from the Calderon, both in terms of how it looks and also distance-wise. It is miles out near the airport in Madrid. Not really hugely close to anything, frankly, but they have fan zones. They've got plans in place to ensure the atmosphere's hopefully somewhere as good as it is at the Calderon. And it will be a hugely impressive 68,000, and it will take Atleti certainly off the pitch to the next level.
You were at the Champions League game against Real Madrid last week, and Atleti this weekend secured group stage football for the Champions League for next season. What makes the Calderon so special for people who haven't been before?
A multitude. First of all, the Atletico supporters, and they are still, despite reaching two finals in the last 3 years in the semi-final, you think of them as this big club, which they are, but they're also a tight-knit group of fans. It wasn't that long ago they were in the second tier. They're traditionally from the more working-class areas, so they'd make a din anywhere, quite frankly. If they were inside the Emirates, they'd make a whole host of noise. So it's mostly down to the supporters. It's also down to the really steep sides in the Calderon, despite the fact only one stand has a roof, which often is a problem. It really rains down on the players. It's in the middle of Madrid, close to the centre, surrounded by housing estates, really. So it's mostly down to the Atleti supporters and where they come from. They know that they're supposed to be loud, so they really ensure that they are. And we'll talk about it a bit later, but at the end, after, remember, they were knocked out, it felt like a celebration on Wednesday night, not like a team and a set of fans who had just seen the knocked out of the Champions League last fall.
Well, let's hear this now. Chris was at the game, obviously, on Wednesday and has a little bit. This is what the Calderon sounded like at full time after losing, going out to their fierce rivals, Real Madrid. What was bizarre about that as well, Chris, was there was a sense of that, you know, that thing where the weather matches the mood, pathetic fallacy, whereby it started raining and they were headed out, but it didn't. If there was a bit of a celebration atmosphere to the end of that game,
it came from nowhere. The rain, it had been forecast, and all of a sudden there was a clap of thunder and the heavens quite literally opened. It was it very poetic. I know a lot of the spoke to Sid Lowe from The Guardian before and then read his follow up piece. It was the type of night that football writers love, because you just had this incredible moment, irrelevant what had happened in the 90 minutes, which was pretty impressive anyway. But yeah, it was always going to be a celebration. It was the Calderon's almost certainly their last European home game. Well, it is now, definitely, because the only way it couldn't have been if they finished fourth and then they don't move to their new stadium until early September. So they might have had to play a playoff, but they don't anymore. They're straight into the group stage. So it was vitally important that they won the game, whatever happened in the tie, and they did. And it was a celebration of the Calderon, many great European evenings, and I think that one was up there. And, you know, Diego Simeone came into the press conference afterwards with a massive smile on his face. Everyone left the ground with a smile on their face, despite the fact they just lost in a semi-final, and they had a real chance after, 30 minutes to go through.
Okay, so the Wanda Metropolitano Stadium, I can never say that, is the new ground.
Yeah.
Wanda being the Chinese company who are putting lots of money into Atletico at the moment. Can you paint us a picture? Because we had a video actually from a listener who said he couldn't get near the stadium. He showed us there's this big fence around it. You actually got inside the new stadium. So what condition is it in at the moment?
Well, it's going to open in early September. I know nothing about construction. The seats are going in this week. No, yeah. Really, do I not look like it? I did have a hard hat for the tour, though.
Did you actually? Did they put you in all like the gear?
We'll tweet it out later.
Oh, excellent.
Great pick.
Excellent.
So the seats, It's always difficult because before the seats are in, you think it's miles off, but actually putting in the seats doesn't take very long. So they're going in starting this week, apparently. 68,000 built on the site. One of the stands was already there. It was a stadium built for two unsuccessful Madrid Olympic bids. So they have this enormous area where the swimming pool would have been, this whole Olympic site. It was a bit of a joke that Madrid spent an awful lot of public money on something that they never even won the bid, and they'd already started construction. So it was a bit of a white elephant, and Atletico sold the Calderon a long time ago. It's going to be flats, unfortunately. So they were, initially they looked to renovate the Calderon. That wasn't possible. So they moved to this already stadium, but they have sort of totally gutted it. One of the stands remains, but the other three don't. It looks like quite a typical stadium. It doesn't look too dissimilar to the Emirates from the inside, actually. And how they make and generate the noise will be interesting. The roof is really cool. There's going to be LED lights so they can light it up in Atletico colours or the Spanish national team colours. There's going to be, as I said, for Spain, there's going to be two big fan zones. And the main argument really has been over the name that you mentioned. A lot of fans would have liked it to be named after maybe Luis Aragonés or someone, but the avenue which it's being built on is called Luis Aragonés Avenue, and apparently they are in discussions with the council to have the address as number 8 Luis Aragonés Avenue, which is obviously the shirt he wore, but apparently that is still being discussed.
I have to build 7 very small houses to get it up to that.
I also asked, or 7 very big trees. I also asked the guy who was showing us around whether there's going to be statues outside, and the answer is yes, but they have to work out exactly who it's going to be. When he said that, he thought, that is a nightmare, isn't it? Because
politically. I mean, I was watching the White Hart Lane celebrations actually yesterday. Yes. And I was thinking, who's made the cut?
Who's made the cut?
Stephen Carr's coming out. This is really up for grabs here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I guess you're like, well, we could just do 5, or we could open it up to like 30. So because it was on the Olympic site, they have a big area around the stadium. They have no worries about, you know, space there. So there's going to be a long avenue, a bit like Wembley Way, up to the stadium. But how they generate the atmosphere, there is a metro stop right next to it, again, built as if it was going to be the Olympic Park. So getting there won't be a problem like some of these out-of-town venues. But how they replicate the Calderon noise, you know, only time will tell.
It's a problem that many people have had, and I'm sure Spurs are concerned about after leaving White Hart Lane this weekend. Chris, let's quickly give people an idea of the situation in La Liga. A quick note, Marcelino, you probably did see this, has been made the Valencia head coach for next season, the former Villarreal and Sevilla boss. Voro, who's been interim charge, actually done an okay job, 13th at the moment, after a dismal season. Marcelino will be their 6th head coach, hired by Peter Lim in 2 years. Let's see if they can sort out that mess there. But really, it's all about the title race this season in Spain. Both Real Madrid and Barcelona won 4-1 at the weekend. Barca with a 4-1 win at Las Palmas. Neymar with a hat-trick set up the other wonderful performance from the Brazilian. And Real Madrid beat Sevilla 4-1. Ronaldo scored twice. It's a result which ironically guaranteed Atletico group stage Champions League football because Sevilla can't catch Real Madrid now. So the situation in Spain is this at the moment. The Barcelona-Real Madrid level on points. Barca with 1 to play. Real Madrid with 2 to play. But Real Madrid, no matter what, the goal difference isn't the factor in Spain. It's head-to-head record. And Barca have that superior head-to-head record. Real Madrid play Celta Vigo on Wednesday, away from home. Then they go away to Malaga on the final day, places where Barcelona have dropped points this season. I mean, credit to both clubs, Chris. This is a phenomenal title race in Spain this year.
Yeah, it is. It's fabulous, isn't it? As you mentioned, Real Madrid with much harder fixtures. Celta away Wednesday. They need to win that to go back top ahead of the last games of the season. Celta have been pretty awful after they reached the Europa League semi-final, yes, but now that they don't have that. And Malaga, as you mentioned, who beat Barcelona a couple of weeks ago in Andalusia. And then Barca at home to Eibar next weekend. Now, you'd be absolutely amazed if Barcelona don't win that. So you're looking at it, and I think Madrid are going to have to win both games to win the title, which they are well capable of. But yeah, what a fascinating end. The only thing that could make it better was if it was an El Clasico in the last game of the season.
Well, we've already had that amazing Clásico this season, yeah. Of course. Barcelona winning at Real Madrid with Messi's goal, last kick of the game. There were some interesting things from the Real Madrid game. First of all, Nacho took a free kick before anyone was ready, and the referee gave it. I'm convinced, I've seen that back, that should not have been given, because sometimes you'll see the player, because you probably didn't see this, but sometimes the player will say to the referee, can I take it? Thierry Henry,
yep.
For example. Oh, it's literally on Sky right now. Chris is seeing it now live. So what do you think to that, Chris? He didn't speak to the referee. The wall's not ready. Your eyes have just opened wide seeing this for the first time.
No, that's not a goal.
It shouldn't count, should it?
No, definitely not. Nobody is ready. I mean, 10 years ago, probably would have been like, oh, it's great thinking to take it so quickly. But given how many times they now haul it back, that is, yeah, that was too quick. It was literally a second after he gave it. You can see why Sevilla were very upset.
Yeah, certainly. Sergio Rico hadn't been able to set his wall or anything. As you'll continue to see on the screen, this is perfect for the medium of radio.
Absolutely, glorious.
But Chris can see that Cristiano Ronaldo went on to score two goals in that game as well. Now 400 for Real Madrid. James appeared to applaud the whole of the stadium as he walked off. Many are saying it's his last game at the Bernabeu. Zidane says it wasn't his farewell, but should James Rodriguez, one of the best number 10s in the world, barely playing, move on, Chris?
I think so. It's also a World Cup year next year, remember. Mm. He needs to be playing 30, 40 games in the build-up to Russia. With Colombia, I think he can command playing as a 10 in almost any other side, frankly. And there will be plenty of suitors, including in the Premier League. Might even get a pay rise if he's lucky to.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think the way that Isco has come in, slightly moving on from topic, but Isco will stay, I think, now. He's absolutely proved to Zinedine Zidane that he is a crucial cog. And who he plays in that Champions League final if Gareth Bale is fit.
I had this chat with Andy Brassel and Adam Summerton on the Champions League podcast, but Isco or Bale for you, both fully fit?
Isco. I think you have to forget the romanticism of Bale being back in Cardiff. I think Zidane will go with Bale. Remember in El Clasico, yeah, he played him when he was not fit at all. The only thing, that backfired, he could afford to lose El Clasico and maybe still win the title because it wasn't a defining game. He can't afford to make a mistake in the Champions League final and not win that. But Isco was magnificent on Wednesday.
Both legs, I thought.
Both legs. But yeah, the way he controlled the game, the way he carried the ball forward, he was my man of the match on Wednesday night, and there were plenty of them. Just to come back as well, because I remembered I forgot something about the Atletico ground.
Go on.
Not in the running order, but they're almost certainly going to do a Liverpool at the start of next season because the ground won't be ready until maybe the weekend after the international break. So
four away games or something to start the season.
Whatever, like Liverpool did when Anfield was still being renovated. Yeah. So,
okay, very interesting.
That'd be interesting. But for them, they'll be delighted to have secured third. Sevilla have really gone off the boil, haven't they?
There's something I was going to come to, Chris. Jorge Sampaoli, after the 4-1 defeat to Real Madrid, lovely goal from Stefan Jovetic, by the way, in that game. Jorge Sampaoli, first season at Sevilla, done a wonderful job, as many will have seen, getting to the Champions League round of 16. But he refused once again to confirm he's going to stay on as Sevilla coach next season. But he says that links with Argentina, the national team of Argentina, is premature. Yeah, do you think the warning signs are that, Chris, that Sampaoli's leaving Sevilla?
Yeah, I was speaking to quite a few Spanish-based journalists as well. That seems that Sevilla will be looking for a new coach and Sampaoli will go to Argentina. Again, look, it's a World Cup year. You don't have to dilly around. Or have to qualify, first of all, of course.
Well, he has to save their campaign.
Has to save their campaign. But what a chance to go there for 12 months and then lead Argentina to a World Cup.
Well, I had someone say to me recently, what's the appeal? He's a La Liga manager, a great club. And I was like, he's Argentinian and it's Argentina, yeah, and a World Cup is 12 months away.
And they've got rather a good team.
They have, not defenders,
but they haven't won the World Cup for quite a long time. Yeah. And given the way Sampaoli sets up his sides,
that could be a great team to watch.
It could be a great team.
It would be a massive loss for Sevilla. A quick one on Portugal, Chris, because Benfica wrapped up their 36th league title, a 5-0 win against Guimarães at the weekend, and they now have 9 more league titles than their rivals Porto.
Yeah, fourth in a row, and given when they lost Jorge Jesus, you wondered whether that era of domination, well, no, it's continued certainly domestically. And a wonderful assist for their goalkeeper, Ederson, who is on the radar of a lot of teams, including Manchester City. And if Pep Guardiola wants someone who can distribute the ball, then I'm sure he will have seen this massive, massive kick. It's not a clearance. It's a massive pass, basically, all the way to the other end of the pitch, controlled down. Goal.
Raul Jimenez, yeah, wonderful goal. It's going to be interesting to see what Manchester City do with their goalkeeper situation. We will talk about Joe Hart later. Big mistakes from him again at the weekend. Also, a very interesting video I found on YouTube. Wired, the tech magazine, one of the biggest tech magazines in the world, did this feature on Benfica's amazing academy. Nuno Gomes, someone I interviewed a couple of years ago, actually works there as well, and the amount of data and the technology they have in their academy is fascinating. I won't ruin that, but the stuff they have on the Tasha football campus where they're identifying talent, they can work out basically like what height a player's going to grow to. All they really incredible, and I'll post that on our Twitter account as well. Benfica looking to become the first team since Porto in the late 90s to win five in a row.
And they celebrated, Rob, something you picked up in a bizarre fashion.
They got a moped in the dressing room and they were doing, what's it called? Like a donut? Donut, it is a donut. Yeah. And the players were going absolutely
berserk.
Come on,
berserk. You grew up in Essex, mate. You know what a donut is.
Yeah, I know. The McDonald's car park in Little Clacton. Yeah, and I wonder if Rui Vitória was in the room at the time or if he'd come in and everyone suddenly stopped
behaving.
What,
the players were doing them?
They had this little moped. I'll show you it while we listen to Richard Connolly's section of the show, but they had a little moped and he's just spinning on the spot on a little moped, but it's absolutely hilarious. So congratulations to Benfica. We'll talk about more titles that have been wrapped up in Europe, including this one, the Dutch title. You probably saw this. I think this is one of the stories of the season. Dirk Kuyt with a hat-trick to win final the title at the weekend. The commentator on this one was Richard Connolly, and I caught up with him earlier.
For more, head to the website, footballineurope.co.uk.
Joining us now on Football in Europe is one of the best commentators around, in my opinion, Richard Connolly, who covers the Eredivisie as seen on Sky Sports. Richard, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Rob, you're very nice. Thank you. It's good to be here.
I sincerely mean that, Richard. I'm speaking to you from your family home today. I understand you're a bit of a walker and talker when you're on the phone.
It's funny. We've just been having a little conversation prior to this, a little friendly chat, in which I did not agree to pay you for saying that I was a good commentator, by the way. And I've been pacing up and down, and I've actually found myself slightly out of breath. So read into that what you will, but I'm not going to be running a marathon anytime soon.
Well, genuinely, Chris Parrott is the most incredible walker and talker on a mobile phone I've ever seen. And he once, I'm not joking, walked up a sofa and down it. I saw that happen while on a mobile phone.
I think that would probably have done for me. So it's as well I've not climbed any stairs.
Mate, we don't want you overexerting yourself. Look, no. We've got to talk about yesterday's game. You were commentating. You were fortunate enough to be the man on Feyenoord against Heracles in the Eredivisie on the final weekend of the season. Many people would have seen what happened, that Feyenoord won 3-1 and that Dirk Kuyt scored a hat-trick. And if you haven't seen the footage back, you really have to find it either on Sky Sports if they're rerunning it or YouTube or something, because Richard, that was maybe one of the most special moments of the season in all of European football. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, nearly 24 hours on, one of the reasons I'm pacing up and down still, actually, is I've still got a lot of energy inside me. And it was an extraordinary, extraordinary occasion. If people do go to the Sky Sports website, actually, you can see a kind of highlights package of the three Kuyt goals and the celebrations from afterwards, which is really nicely put together. So that is well worth checking out. It was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, it's one of those days where there was going to be nothing in between. It was going to be triumph, and it was going to be tearful, the first title in a generation, or it was going to be utterly crushing. The biggest chance in a generation completely blown, because in context, the week before, they should have won the title away to a much, much smaller club there, Rotterdam neighbours, Excelsior, and a win would have sealed the title then, and the cap was packed with fans watching it on big screens waiting for the trophy presentation, and they lost 3-0, incredibly, to this much inferior team because they had a collective loss of nerve, and it was distinctly possible that that could happen again in front of their home fans with tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people watching on big screens in the streets of Rotterdam. The atmosphere prior to kickoff was utterly sensational, and all of this was riding on it. People were literally crying before the game had kicked off. And then, would you believe it, in the first minute, the Heracles defender, Mike Tavirik, slipped on his backside after they'd taken a long throw, and Dirk Kuyt was gambling, and he gambled on the slip, and he was in behind, and for a tight angle, he produced the most astonishingly calm finish inside 40 seconds, and the whole place went utterly, utterly bananas. And the fact that it was Kuyt, and it was actually his 100th league goal for Feyenoord as well, which had kind of been in the offing for a while, but he hadn't played the week before. He's not been a regular first-team starter over the last couple of months. But there he was with a fairy tale moment so early in the game. And from that point on, you just thought, I mean, can this barely get any better? But of course it did.
Dirk Kuyt, the pictures of Dirk Kuyt at the end with the Feyenoord fans is really special. And obviously he's a club hero there, went back, I want to say a couple of years ago anyway, after spells away in Turkey, yeah, and of course with Liverpool. But in the last few months, from what I remember, maybe even chatting to you conversationally, Richard, is that things hadn't been going to plan for Dirk Kuyt on a personal level while Feyenoord were challenging for the title. They were largely doing it without him, and he wasn't especially happy at being on the bench at such a crucial time for the club.
No, I mean, I think his relationship with Giovanni Van Bronckhorst, from what I can glean, has been a sort of potential area for difficulty, because he is such a key figure, more so than a key player in these last few months, but such an influential figure, somebody whose voice is so valuable in the dressing room, and it has actually, I think, still been a tremendously positive influence over the last few weeks, but somebody who clearly also wanted to play every week. But it did clearly sort of emerge during the course of this season. And last season, he pretty much played every game. And you're right, this is the second season of his return. But certainly in the second half of last season, and remember last season, they were very competitive up until Christmas and then lost seven games in a row. And part of that was a sort of diminished physicality. And of course, the count, you know, he's nearly 37, and they're trying to work out what he was capable of all the time. And the truth was, he wasn't part of their best 11 in the second half of the season. But when it came to the game away at Excelsior last week, which we mentioned, which they lost, they did not have a calming influence, a guiding light on the field, and collectively they crumbled. And it became very apparent that actually what they needed was that person in the game that mattered absolutely more than anything. And Tommy Vilhena, who's been a key player, young player, who may see at a big club before too long, got suspended, very unfortunately for him, for a fifth yellow card right at the end of the season. So he missed yesterday's game, and it was perfect for Kuyt to come in. And obviously he led the way with his example of scoring that early goal. But his voice around the field, because there are various characters, and there are some characters in his side or team who can be a little disruptive, who can get very down, very grumpy, and he was keeping things together. You could see it throughout the game.
Because you mentioned that the nerves that had almost affected them the week before. I'm sure for Feyenoord fans, what happened on Sunday is a happy trade-off for what happened away at Excelsior the week before. Mm. I want to talk to you about Giovanni Van Bronckhorst, Richard, because, I mean, on a European level, he's probably not a coach who's talked about a great deal. And I remember interviewing him, it would be 4 years ago now, because it was just in the lead-up to the 2013 final. And he wasn't a manager then. He was wearing a baseball cap backwards, big trainers. And he still looked like a footballer to me, if you see what I mean. And then yeah. I see him being interviewed after the game yesterday in floods of tears. How good is this guy as a coach?
Well, I think it's always very difficult specifically to narrow it down, but I think what his skill to me appears to be is as a figurehead, as somebody who is fully aware of what he possesses, of what he needs around him, and a unifier, a presence, a quiet, nice guy with a lot of respect from a terrific playing career. And he'd won the league in Scotland with Rangers, he'd won the league in England with Arsenal, he'd won the league in Spain with Barcelona, but he'd never won the Dutch league as a player. So an absolute mission for him, as much as it was for Dirk Kuyt. But somebody who was, who could, with a career like that, have had a massive ego, quite frankly. And you know, you'd say rightly so, really. One of the big playing names, more than 100 caps for the Netherlands. His last game as a player was a World Cup final. And yet, when he started management, and he's only been in the role for pretty much exactly 2 years, because he took over at the end of the season before last. But he had the kind of humility to invite Dick Advocaat on board early on for a couple of months to provide counsel and advice. And he's used the experience of Jean-Paul Van Gastel, who was a teammate of his, who was the captain when they had won the league the last time. And he's got Roy Mackay on board, and he's got Jan Wouters on board. And Wouters is a much more combative character, was a much more combative player, I suppose you'd say. But all of these individuals contribute different things. Advocaat, obviously, is not involved anymore, and he's now the coach of the Netherlands again. But he's been able to invite, it's not exactly a team of rivals, but you get where I'm going. He's been able to assimilate all these voices, take all these different voices on board, let those individual voices be heard, and yet still retain the authority to make the final decisions. I think that's been his strength.
So Feyenoord winning the title after this long wait, they win it by a point ahead of Ajax, who also won on the final day. And I want to ask you a quick one on them in a moment as they prepare to face Manchester United in the Europa League final. They won 3-1 at Willem II at the weekend, Dolberg scoring again. But on Feyenoord, the streets of Rotterdam were packed. Richard, what does it mean to those supporters and largely the people of that city to have the champions in Feyenoord once again?
Well, I think it's not exactly been 18 years of pain for the club and for the city, which Feyenoord fans will tell you is the best supported club in terms of numbers in the Netherlands, beyond Ajax. But because they won the UEFA Cup in 2002. But between there and winning the Cup last year, triumphs have been very few and far between, and they were beaten 10-0 famously by PSV in 2010. And the club was really teetering financially for a long time. And they have felt, the Feyenoord fans in large number, that they have been oftentimes humiliated. And yet they've kept turning up and filling the Kuip every week, nearly 50,000, and making it one of the loudest, most raucous stadiums in Europe. And they really had nothing to show for it. And they felt like the butt of a bad joke a lot of the time. And, you know, bearing in mind the last title was 1999, you have to be kind of 25-ish to even remember it. So for young fans growing up, they'd never seen it. And, you know, they, I guess you always wonder, time passes very slowly when you're young, you always wonder if it's going to happen. And for the dads and the mums of those young fans watching the games, who've been trying to persuade them to go to see Feyenoord is a good idea, you know, it's finally that reassurance that actually they've done something worthwhile and have brought some big joy into their lives. So it's huge. And as an aside, it was also yesterday the anniversary of the Blitz of Rotterdam in the Second World War, 77 years to the day. So there were a lot of flags with the Rotterdam coat of arms on yesterday with the date broadly printed across them. You know, you never want to bring such serious matters into sport as best you can. But that was in people's minds as well. As you say, the streets were absolutely full. And it was about more than just Feyenoord. It was certainly about a city restoring its pride.
Richard, as part of the commentators' union, is it difficult to come down after a game like that? Such a thrilling finale to the end of the season?
Yeah, I'm still pacing. And yeah, it was really quite strange. You kind of come off air and you've got all this pent-up energy. And quite often what happens is that relatively early in the evening, you're buzzing, you hit a wall, and then you just collapse and you sleep for a long time. And yesterday was a strange occasion because it didn't really happen to me. So I was awake and I was causing disturbance to others in the house. It's only, and I just thought, okay, and I came downstairs at 1:30 in the morning and started watching the game back again to try and relive it, to try and process what had gone on, and to see what it looked like and what it sounded like to the viewer, because you never quite get a grasp of exactly how it comes across.
No, I'm sure you got more sleep. I'm sure you got more sleep than the final players anyway.
Well, yeah, they'd have had a it would have been a hell of a celebration. Quite frankly, I suspect it's still going on.
Let's have a quick one on Ajax. They came very close. They really made up a big margin on Feyenoord to push it to the final day. I think I saw, once again, another one of those average age statistics that on the final day, the average age of their team was below 20, which, you know, is still absolutely staggering. They prepared to face Manchester United in the Europa League final. How good is this Ajax side at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, just to provide a for Ajax Feyenoord context, I think the Ajax side average age was younger than Feyenoord's youngest player yesterday on the final day of the season. They are stunning. And frankly, they end the season as on form, the best team right now. That's not to say that Feyenoord don't deserve to be champions. It's the reverse of that. Feyenoord over the piece, fine. But Ajax beat them well at the start of April to close that gap. And you could see then that Ajax were flying. And, you know, they've been flying in Europe. And as we've seen, people across the world have taken note of what's happened. It's a collection of an academy producing brilliant young talent that are way ahead of their years. A coach who met and knew Johan Cruyff a little bit and had his own style, but very much buys into Ajax attacking philosophies of the past, and who has chosen the young players correctly, but has also managed to find roles for more senior guys like Lasse Schürrle. And what he's achieved in a season is phenomenal. And they haven't won the league, but if they win the European trophy, for many, I think it will probably dwarf the achievements of Frank de Boer, who won four consecutive titles at the start of this decade, because European success for Dutch clubs has been so thin on the ground. Feyenoord UEFA Cup triumph 15 years ago was the last Dutch success. So we could talk for 20 minutes about them, but it has been utterly phenomenal. I mean, I guess Justin Kluivert and Matthijs de Ligt, as we've spoken about before, are the two teenage stars who have really burst through this season incredibly well.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, and I'll be seeing you soon for the Champions League final as well.
Look forward to it, sir. Keep well.
For more, head to the website, footballineurope.co.uk.
A big thanks to Richard Connolly, as always. Brilliant guest to have on the show. And Feyenoord champions, Ajax missing out by 1 point. Titles are being won across Europe as we're in May, and things are being done and dusted. Chris Parrott's alongside me. Chris, first of all, quick one on the Ukrainian Premier League. This was actually won the previous weekend, but Shakhtar Donetsk are champions once again.
Yeah, Paulo Fonseca in charge. Now playing most of their games in Kharkiv, in the east of Ukraine, far closer to where Shakhtar's traditional home is, in Donetsk. They're just the 17 points clear of Dynamo Kiev. And they can do the double this week. They play Dynamo in the final of the Ukrainian Cup. That'll be quite an evening. And they play in Kharkiv as well, which gives Shakhtar a little bit of an advantage.
That's superb. Okay, let's, another side who wrapped up the title the previous weekend was Spartak Moscow.
Yeah.
Chris, yourself and I both cover the Russian Premier League as one of the leagues we really commentate on. For people who haven't seen Spartak, we'll ask you two questions. First of all, how did they win the title? Why were they so comprehensive this season?
I think Antonio Conte and Chelsea, not quite the same formation. So Massimo Carrera, you need to give the backstory. So sorry for jibber and jabber on, but Spartak were a national joke, basically, for about the last 5-6 years, longer probably. 16 years since they last won the Russian Premier League, given they won 9 of the first 10 titles. They were, I think, Manchester United era of domination times 2 or 3, then going 16 years without ever really coming that close. They sacked their coach at the start of this season, a few games in, after they lost a Europa League qualifier to Ike Larnaca of Cyprus. You know, everyone was like, where are Spartak going in this big new stadium?
I wish I could have taken a photo of your face as you said, Ike Larnaca of Cyprus.
Big new stadium built for the World Cup. Massimo Carrera, one of Conte's assistants, had been brought in as an assistant at Spartak, got the top job, and almost overnight turned them into this incredibly well-drilled defensive unit who all work and run for each other all day, which is the most impressive thing given how much of a mess they've been. And also a sprinkling of real stardust with Quincy Promise, the Dutch winger, who is the player in the Russian Premier League, will probably leave this summer. And then in January, we're able to bring in reinforcements, including Luis Adriano, to have a genuine finisher up front.
Yeah, he didn't quite make it in Milan, really.
But he will at Spartak. That's how they won it. They won a lot of games narrowly. They won a lot of games with quite late goals. They're just a very, very well-organised, well-drilled side with some superb individual talents.
So why was this so significant for the club to win the league titles? CSKA, Moscow and Zenit have had a spell of dominance, really.
Because that 16-year wait for Spartak to do it, it's been quite a number of years since they were even in the Champions League. This for the easily the best supported side in Russia, easily, and quite frankly, the biggest side. Zenit fans will probably be shouting at the podcast now, but certainly their history suggests that. And they've been overtaken, is the simple fact. They've thrown loads of money, loads of coaches at it. You think of the amount of foreign coaches. They even had Unai Emery for, you know, a spell. They were going through coaches, very good coaches, left, right and centre. Now they've got Carrera, who they just seem a thoroughly together team and club. There's still some mad things going on behind the scenes, but Carrera has managed to brush that off. And they certainly now have a platform, Spartak, to, you know, they're not going to win 9 out of 10 titles, but if they can keep this going, add a couple more excellent players this summer, you feel that this could be the beginning of something for Spartak.
Just to discuss some of the good, promising, up-and-coming coaches that they have burned through.
Yeah.
Unai Emery, Michael Laudrup, and Murray Yakin, who was brilliant at Basel. You know, it was a poison chalice almost to take over at that club. So Spartak have wrapped it up. There is still stuff to play for in Russia. Interesting, the Zenit have had to go back to the Petrovsky because the pitch of the new Zenit Arena is too much of a problem. So they had their big farewell and have had to go back before the end of the season. So Zenit and CSKA Moscow are now challenging for the Champions League, Chris. And you were commentating on the latter on Friday night.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly for Zenit and Michail Lucescu, his first season, big things expected, big budget. If he doesn't get second, it will be a serious failure. And same for CSKA, who were champions. Leonid Slutsky's left, Viktor Hancharenko has come in and improved, and they now play three at the back. I commentated on a very comfortable win. They both played struggling teams and beat them comfortably. CSKA were 3-0 winners. Interesting one, Fyodor Chalov, who they haven't had a striker, CSKA, really, for, you know, they lost Musa, going back to
Seydou Doumbia or something.
Yeah,
no, probably.
Lucina Traore was there on loan from Monaco. He left.
Awful,
yeah. But they've never been able to replace those goals. 19-year-old, one of this exciting crop of Russian players, scored two more goals, set up one by Golovin. And really, those two guys are going to be crucial to Russia, who, remember, host the World Cup next summer, have the Confederations Cup this summer. They're ranked, Rob, 61 in the world.
Russia are ranked 61 in the world?
That is their lowest ever. They are behind Panama and Uzbekistan. Yeah? Now, okay.
Oh my word, I did not know that. FIFA, ahead of a World Cup, I mean, that's
World Cup
so embarrassing.
In your home country, so we look at FIFA world rankings, I know, sometimes, and they're a bit of, you know,
skewy, yeah.
But they've barely won a friendly since Euro. Slutsky, of course, left. Cherchesov, already people are saying, is he the right man? And the Confederations Cup, if it could be a bit of a national embarrassment for them. So he's picked his 30-man squad today, actually, Monday, as we're recording. He hasn't picked Chalov, who presumably in a year's time will definitely be in the squad. But this is a big summer for the Russian national team because, you know,
maybe he's thinking, I don't have time to try and bed someone in.
Probably.
We need to get results.
It's very difficult to be critical of him, the new coach, because there isn't the talent, really.
It really comes back to Fabio Capello's era, doesn't it? He did have a good team and it has sort of ebbed away and they've been massively disappointing. Okay, Chris, let's go to Serie A. We're going to hear from Adam Summerton in a moment. Napoli briefly moved into second position in Serie A after a 5-0 win at Torino. Cajon, Insigne, Mertens and Zielinski all on the score sheet, two for Cajon, in fact. Very poor performance from Joe Hart, a person we've talked about a lot on the show, still England's number one goalkeeper. There's no way he's... Torino, for starters, won't buy him. I saw on BT Sport, they said only one goalkeeper's made more individual errors statistically than Hart. Where does Joe Hart go next, Chris? Is it lower half Premier League? Is it he's tried going abroad? It doesn't seem to have sorted him out. And his shot stopping, it's gone to pot. Just quickly, I mean, it's 5 years since the QPR win, since City beat QPR, won the title. And Joe Hart, I saw a lot of him that season, best goalkeeper in the league by a mile at the time. And it's hard to understand for a player who's still young by goalkeeper standards, the drop-off. I mean, what do you think? Where do you think he goes now?
I think the right coach and the right setup pretty quickly see Joe Hart back to that level. It must have been on a personal level to be shipped out by Guardiola so publicly. And you know, Torino, I'm sure he'll look back on it as a wonderful adventure. But for Joe Hart suddenly to, you're moving to Turin. You know, if we'd said that this time last year.
Well, you'd think you're mad.
I think you're mad. No one would be downloading this podcast. is anyone?
Hello?
But you know, I think there are plenty of big Premier League clubs. I mean, you look round. Everton looking for a new goalkeeper. Arsenal could do with a new goalkeeper. If David De Gea leaves, Manchester United are looking for a new goalkeeper, which would be quite the move.
I don't think any of those three would be looking at Hart.
I think one of them might. If not, then yeah, you suddenly look, well, where's Joe Hart going to go?
Maybe Everton, who he was linked with at the back end of the transfer window anyway.
Particularly on the wage front as well. Maybe if Kasper Schmeichel leaves Leicester. Now, that is probably a mid-table Premier League team, coming back to your original question, but they'll definitely have their eye on a top six finish next season, Leicester. And maybe if Schmeichel does leave, I'm not saying he's going to, I think Joe Hart is suited to playing in the Premier League. And I'd be very surprised if he's not playing in the Premier League next season.
He probably needs to be playing under the nose of the England manager, doesn't he, as well? Ahead of the World Cup.
Because Fraser Forster is an extremely good goalkeeper.
Yeah, as he showed against Liverpool recently.
And if Jack Butland gets fit, he's not going to be England's number one, I don't think.
Yet.
Next World Cup, yet.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
there is competition, and you know, Joe Hart has a lot of proving to do after his performance at Euro.
Okay, so Napoli's win put them into second briefly before the big Sunday night game in Italy, which was, did you notice I just started doing like that Italian gesture they do when they go mad at the referees? Anyway, so Roma played Juventus on Sunday night.
Radio medium, we need some sort of webcam.
I know, I'm sorry everyone. Roma beat Juventus 3-1, Roma coming from behind to beat a Juve side. Granted, there were changes to that Juve team. Max Allegri has tended to do that for the latter stages of the league campaign, given their advancement to the Champions League final. Big win for Roma. They did it without Edin Dzeko. He was watching from the stands as De Rossi, El Shaarawy, and the superb Nainggolan all scored. Lamina had actually put Juve in front. So Juve don't win the title yet. 4 points clear with two to go. They will win it.
Yeah.
They will win it. But a big win for Roma in search of automatic Champions League qualification.
Massive. Particularly given Italian club's record in the playoff round of the Champions League. It is terrible. Absolutely awful, including, recently, basically, if you finish third, you end up going into the Europa League group stage. That'll all change. But yeah, maintain their very slender lead over Napoli. Interesting, I think, from Juve's point of view at this stage of the season, you know, they started with Alves, Dybala, Chiellini on the bench. They've got Crotone at home this weekend. Now, they'll beat them and they'll wrap up their sixth straight Scudetto.
Yeah, Crotone 18th, still looking to survive. They could still survive, but, that you know, 8 wins from 36 games.
So I think, you know, but yeah, really big win from Roma's point of view. And actually, if you look at heads, so it's been very much a one-horse race in Italy for such a long time. All three of those teams, I think, in terms of, it's been a long time since Italian teams have truly dominated the Champions League or had lots of clubs in the latter stages. Obviously, Juventus are in the final. I know they've done very well. But you do feel that Roma and Napoli are two clubs really on the rise. We're going to have Monchi at Roma. You know, I've always said this. Everything is cyclical. And Serie A for not this season, particularly not with Juventus. I think people have sort of thought La Liga or Premier League is definitely the two best leagues. Well, I think you're going to have three clubs in Serie A. Those three. Napoli, Roma and Juve, who could really do some damage in Europe for the next period of time, particularly with more money. And if one of the Milan clubs can get their act together and join those three, I think Serie A all of a sudden, again, will be a real leading lead.
Well, we'll see if Juve in Rome at the Stadio Olimpico can wrap up the Coppa Italia title. They take on Lazio on Wednesday, a Lazio side that have scored 2, 9, 12, 18 goals in their last four games. Absolutely incredible. Beaten by Fiorentina at the weekend 3-2.
So I was going to say, did you see there was also almost a Europa League playoff, really, Atalanta. Basically, they just had to not lose to Milan, and they didn't. They got a 1-1 draw. So they should finish in the European places. And coach Gianpiero Gasperini saying, yeah, the Europa League will be the priority over Serie A next season. Isn't that refreshing?
It is very refreshing. I mean, seeing the Celta Vigo players in absolute tears at the end of that Manchester United game, I think was a reminder to the Premier League that in other countries that game was a huge deal on Thursday night against Manchester United. Okay, we're going to stay with Serie A for a moment because Inter, chaos at Inter at the moment. They've just appointed a new director of football. They are 8 games without a win. They haven't won in 2 months. They were beaten 2-1 by Sassuolo at the weekend at home at San Siro. The fans walked out on 20 minutes with a banner saying, "We're going for a lunch break." And of course, last week they sacked Stefano Pioli. Inter have invested major money from the Suning, a Chinese retail group who've invested vast amounts, and yet they're still absolutely awful. Earlier in the week, I caught up with BT Sport commentator Adam Summerton to ask what on earth is happening with the Nerazzurri.
This is Football in Europe, Serie A Roundup.
Adam Summerton joins us on the podcast. Why did Inter sack Pioli, Adam?
It's all down to results. They've really tailed off quite badly after what was a very good start to his time with Inter. I think surprisingly good. The way that he sorted out the defence in particular for me was quite striking, the turnaround in that respect. And the results were very good, so much so that there was even the feeling that this wasn't perhaps going to be a stopgap, which is what a lot of people thought. And he could well, you know, end up staying for longer term and certainly into next season. But the last couple of months, the results have dropped off dramatically after they'd beaten actually Atalanta 7-1, one of the surprises of the season. So it has really dropped off. They haven't won in 7. They've lost 5 of them. And it's gone very sour indeed for Pioli. So it is purely down to result. I say that, although, of course, we don't know yet whether Inter maybe have got a nod off someone who they're looking to approach that they would be willing to come in. But I think right now we can say that it's just gone very sour.
You seem to have sympathy for Pioli and the job he was put into.
Yeah, I do, because I think the inherited a very difficult situation. As you could say, his predecessor, Frank de Boer, did when Mancini left 2 weeks before the start of the season, when a lot of the preparation had been done. It was hard for de Boer to come in because de Boer's a very different man. He's a very different coach to Mancini. And it was going to take clearly a long time for a Dutch coach to come in. Who'd never coached, you know, anything other than a Dutch side, of course, did so well at Ajax. So I think that when they invested in someone like De Boer, it surely had to be for the long term because they knew there would be quite a lengthy bedding in process, but they felt the results were so bad that he just had to go so early on in the season. And then Pioli was basically having to pick up, you know, a mess, essentially. And I thought that he did start extremely well, but this is the problem with Inter is that we've seen 3 managers there and 3 pretty big names in the space of 9 months, who've all come and gone. The problem at Inter is that it goes beyond the managers. There's a lot going on behind the scenes, obviously with the takeover as well. There's a lot to be managed with that. We've just seen Sabatini as well appointed, who will do a lot of work behind the scenes. There is money there to be spent, but I think that when you watch them on the pitch and you look at the results and you see the problems, It's clearly there is problems in the squad. There's problems, I think, that we probably aren't even aware of. I think that to me it looks like there's disharmony within the squad that has carried over from manager to manager, and I think it's going to take a lot of unraveling. I heard someone describe the way Inter are, because there was the turnaround when Pioli first came in and everything seemed to be going well. They were playing so well, they were getting good results, they were putting good performances. And someone described it almost as like someone who's got an addiction, say, I don't know, say a drug addiction or an alcohol addiction, where they have a phase where they come off it and everything's great, and then suddenly there's a relapse and everything just goes back to where it was again. And I thought, so some people might be uncomfortable with that analogy, I actually thought it was a really good way of describing the way Inter are, because it's in a nutshell for me.
So these problems are more deep-rooted, perhaps, with the ownership and everything that's happened upstairs that's filtered down to the dugout?
Yeah, I think so. I just think that as well, it's just squad harmony. I think there are some big characters in there as well. And whether they're all singing from the same hymn sheet. I mean, if you compare it with Juventus, when I watch Juventus, I can see a team where everybody's on the same page. Everybody has been well drilled in terms of the coach. Everybody knows their roles. Nobody necessarily thinks that they're any more important than anybody else. And that is how they've created this incredible team ethic. Someone said to me the other day, Juve haven't really got like a standout superstar, have they? Which sounds a ridiculous thing to say when they spent 90 million on Higuain, when they've got, you know, Bonucci, who's arguably the most valuable defender in the world right now. But
it's true, though.
Yeah, I could totally see what they meant. And I think whereas Icardi is the standout star at Inter, I don't want to pin it all on Icardi because I think he's, the issues that there have been with him are one of many. But even if you just take him in isolation and you look at the issues that there have been off the pitch with him, the verbal clash with supporters that was, you know, led to supporters saying take the captaincy off him, it was very, very unseemly. That is one example of what I'm talking about, the disharmony that there is that will spread amongst the squad. And there have been players who've come in for huge money, who've not settled, who've not maybe found their role in the side. Kondogbia is one, João Mário is another. Huge, huge sums of money were paid for both of them. Mm. And I don't think we've seen anything like the best of either of them yet. There have been flashes of Kondogbia and there have been flashes with João Mário, but not consistently for any period of time. And there's also the issue of Gabriel Barbosa as well. I mean, a player who's brought in for another huge fee. We've barely seen him this season. And Inter fans quite rightly say, why? You know, why is this guy just sat on the bench all the time? He's barely even been given a chance. So there are lots of little issues going on right throughout the squad, which again sort of magnifies this disharmony, this discontent, this lack of camaraderie that I see quite regularly on the pitch.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
Big thanks to Adam Summerton, as always, for coming on the podcast. One of the very best that we get on Football in Europe. Chris Parrott still with me for the final part of the show. Chris, it's a bit like the old days. Three parts, two guests.
I know.
It's like we're not slacking.
Well, the season's coming to an end. There's a bit more time.
That's true enough. We're giving you what you deserve. Okay, so let's do a quick one on Liga. Monaco could have won the title on Sunday night. They didn't quite wrap it up, but through no fault of their own. Chris, give us the situation as they close in on an historic event in their history.
Well, they can win the title on Wednesday, Rob. They need just a point at home to Saint-Étienne, who were thumped by PSG, but Monaco beating Lille 4-0 at the weekend. Two goals for Falcao, two assists from Mbappe, 102 goals now in Ligue 1 this season. They will be worthy winners and be a miracle if they don't get what they need against Saint-Étienne to wrap it up before the last game of the season.
Yeah, I think that 102, actually, I think that's what PSG got last year, which was a record. Yeah. So, absolutely remarkable. Worth noting as well, Christophe Galtier is leaving Saint-Étienne after 7.5 years in charge. He was the second longest serving head coach of the top leagues in Europe behind Arsene Wenger. And even Carlo Ancelotti sent him a letter to say congratulations on your spell at Saint-Étienne. He's generally not a classy guy, Carlo. Always classy, Carlo Ancelotti.
Yes, what a coach. Also, just of note, actually, you look at the job that Sergio Conceição has done at Nantes, who looking like they might be heading down, and all of a sudden they're 7th or 8th now, and he's picked up in his time there as many points as Nice and Marseille, I think. So he's done a very good job. We mentioned Paulo Fonseca. There's a whole generation of young, very talented Portuguese coaches who will almost certainly get jobs in the Premier League.
Yeah, well, no doubt. By the way, Bastia, who are banned from playing in their stadium at the moment after the events during the Lyon game where players were attacked, won their second game on the mainland playing away from their stadium. And believe it or not, they're not relegated yet. 2 points inside the drop zone where the games go. Somehow they might survive, and maybe that stadium, moving away from the pressure of playing at home, has done them some good.
Yeah. Although, a brave man to suggest that they permanently decide to move to the mainland.
Guys, don't you think it's better over here? Absolutely right. Okay, let's talk about the Bundesliga, Chris.
Yeah.
I was commentating on Hoffenheim and their win at Bremen at the weekend.
8 goals, lucky boy.
Yeah, amazing. It was 5-0 by the 51st minute. Bremen missing a suspended defender, Nicolas Moisander. Bremen had won 9 in 12 and was suddenly in the Europa League contention back in on the 20th match day of the season. They were in the relegation zone. So it's been an amazing turnaround, but Hoffenheim tore them to pieces. Impressive because last week Hoffenheim had been beaten by Dortmund in what they were saying was the a Champions League third place playoff in essence. So Hoffenheim is still fourth at the moment. 2 goals for Andre Kramaric, a player who didn't make it at Leicester. He was signed by Leicester just when they were working out.
Yeah.
We're pretty good if we just play Jamie Vardy up front.
Exactly. You think how many goals he scored in Croatia. He's still very young as well.
He is, yeah. 15 league goals this season now. 1 game to go in the campaign. And he took his 2 goals brilliantly. I mean, a really good signing for Hoffenheim. And a blow for Bremen that effectively ends their European ambitions. But their head coach, Alex Nouri, had already said the season has been, we've achieved what we wanted to achieve, getting out of the relegation zone. Anything else would be spectacular.
Still have a negative goal difference, Bremen, considering that they are 8th.
And what was interesting was Hoffenheim, when they got it to 5-0 in the 51st minute, was suddenly ebbing away at Dortmund's goal difference, because that's all that separates the two teams. So it was 5-0, and they were 1 goal away from Dortmund, who drew with Augsburg at the weekend. But then they conceded 3. They sort of fell apart in the final half an hour. And I was thinking, you know, when Liverpool played Palace and threw away that game when they were thinking they could make up the goal difference on City. Apparently, the players didn't know. Andre Kramaric came out and said after, if we had any idea that had really clocked what was happening, either we would have shut up shop and looked to make up that goal difference on the final day of the season, or we might have been a bit more clinical with our chances.
Really?
They
didn't know.
He said they hadn't really worked it out in their heads.
Look at the table.
I know, exactly. Because even if Dortmund are winning in the other game, goal difference might still play a role in it. So, regardless. But, Chris, a relegation zone. This is interesting. Hamburg, Wolfsburg next weekend. It's essentially a relegation playoff. Do you have the table in front of you? Do you want to paint the picture?
Certainly do. So, two big institution, big names in German football. Hamburg, bottom two go down. Ingolstadt, Darmstadt relegated. Hamburg are third bottom, so would go into that relegation playoff where they have been for a number of years and quite literally miraculously stayed up with late goals and all sorts. It's amazing they've still never been relegated from the Bundesliga. They are 2 points behind Wolfsburg. Far worse goal difference. They're also 2 points behind Augsburg and Mainz. All 3 of those teams, Mainz, Augsburg, Wolfsburg, have 37 points. So Hamburg, if they beat Wolfsburg at home, will be safe. What a game that will be.
Yeah, because it would in essence send Wolfsburg into the relegation playoff spot. And it's much like we had last season with Frankfurt and Bremen last year, where Bremen sent Frankfurt into that. Augsburg are not safe. Mainz are, even though they're on 37 points, along with Augsburg and Wolfsburg, due to goal difference. Mainz really... I don't even want to try and work out what would have to happen for them to go down.
Do you know what, Rob? Leverkusen. You know, sometimes when you look down the table and you think, oh my word. I mean, they're not going to go down. They can't. They're only 3 points clear of Hamburg.
Yeah.
Disaster of a campaign.
Interesting weekend in the derby against Cologne at the weekend. They were 2-0 down, pulled it back to 2-2. But the club said afterwards, before they'd even told Tefan Korkut, the head coach, that he was leaving, they told the media that he will not be staying beyond the end of the season.
That's a nice
I think it actually symbolises the mess that they've been in. And Mainz really have saved themselves. 2-0 down at Frankfurt at the weekend. 1-4-2 in the end somehow, with 4 goals in the final half an hour. And Bayern were 4-2 down away at Leipzig, their first ever visit to the Red Bull Arena, with 6 minutes to go, and they won 5-4.
That's the Bundesliga at its very best this weekend.
The weekend was absolutely crazy. So, of course, Leipzig guaranteed second. Dortmund, Hoffenheim still playing for third and fourth. And the Europa League, wide open. Too many permutations to really go through. So, Chris, we've sort of covered all the top leagues. But who could be playing their football in the top leagues next season? Who's coming up? Should we do it country by country, actually? If I just shout a nation at you, you have to do it. Ready? Okay, Bulgaria.
Iceland. Yes.
Okay. So I'll just pick a country. Spain. Who's going up in Spain?
Okay, Levante promoted. Girona a second. But the final games of this league aren't until the 11th of June.
Really?
Yeah, I know. It's almost a month away. which is remarkable. So Girona are well clear in second, but they're not quite promoted because of how many games there are to go. And at the other end, Rob, Real Mallorca heading down to the third tier.
Wow.
Right,
huge club
mess.
Going down. Yeah, what a mess. Okay, France.
France, one game to go. Now, this is brilliant. The top six sides are separated by 3 points.
Say that again. The top six are separated by 3 points.
So six sides can still go up. Their goal differences are very similar. The top two go up in France. The third goes into promotion playoff. Strasbourg are currently top. They're a big club. They haven't been in the top flight for quite a while. Amiens are second and Troyes are third. Lens, Brest and Nîmes could all go up as well, depending on what happens. Friday night is going to be an absolute thriller.
Oh, wow. Is that when all the games are then?
All the games kick off. And yeah, six sides could still go up. Strasbourg, I haven't quite worked out the permutations, but they could easily finish fourth or they could win the title. at the other end, another, you know, Auxerre. Champions
wow.
League not that long ago. They could drop into the relegation playoff to go down to the third tier. And the third tier in France, it's not like England where you have Sheffield United and clubs of that size. Some extremely small clubs that Auxerre could be playing alongside.
It's into the abyss. Okay, what have we not done? Germany.
Germany. Well, this is another corker. So, big clubs here. Stuttgart are top and are up. They lost to Hanover at the weekend, who jumped into second ahead of their local rivals Eintracht Braunschweig, who lost and really had an absolute disaster. So Hanover are three clear with a much better goal difference. So they're almost certainly up with Stuttgart, and Eintracht Braunschweig will go into the playoff against either Hamburg or Wolfsburg or Augsburg.
Yeah, and
they really messed up at the weekend.
Yeah, they lost 6-0 to relegation-threatened Arminia Bielefeld as well, didn't they?
They had a nightmare because they were in pole position to join Stuttgart.
Wow.
And send Hanover into the playoffs, but now Hanover basically top. And we mentioned them a while ago, but the two former East German powerhouses, Union Berlin and Dynamo Dresden, ran out of puff in the end, so they're not involved. So it's either Hanover or Eintracht Braunschweig to join Stuttgart in the automatic, and it almost certainly will be Hanover.
Okay, in Italy, finally.
Now, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, because it's one of those that look like a right clown if I don't. Spal. Spal.
Spal.
S-P-A-L are promoted. And it'll either be Hellas Verona or Frosinone who will join them. And either of those teams, if they finish third, will join five other sides who go into the promotion playoff for the final promotion place.
Burn all of that information into your brains.
Yep, because we've seen across Europe the amount of teams who come up with a little bit of momentum and maybe money behind them, and all of a sudden, like Leipzig, they finish second. So it's nice to have a look who it might be. And as I mentioned, there's some big sides who are either going to be back up in the top flight or potentially heading to the third tier.
Okay, I think that's everything. Staying on Italy very quickly, I forgot to mention this earlier. I don't really know. This isn't really a discussion point, but Napoli have signed a partner, a new branding partner in Tinder.
They.
Yeah, and Arkadiusz Milik has a profile on
that. That is so Napoli.
It's very Napoli, isn't it? Very Napoli. And you can, not a date, but four people can go out for dinner with Arkadiusz Milik. I wanted to read the quote. So this is the quote from Milik. If Milik said this, I will buy everyone a pizza. Right, Milik, I'm really proud to be part of this unique and innovative initiative with Tinder. The fans here have always given me a warm welcome, and it's really amazing to be able to interact with them differently. Technology brings people together, just like sports, and I look forward to starting this new adventure.
No,
did Milik say that?
Stop. Football's ruined. Let's all give up.
It's not ruined. Look at the French second tier. How exciting is all that?
I'm going to go and watch the Giro d'Italia. That is... you've made me really angry for the rest of Monday now.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right. On that note, we're done. Super long, but really long one this week. I hope you're still listening at this point. if you do enjoy the show, it's at FIE Podcast to get in touch. And if people want to help us out in the iTunes charts, what do they do, Chris?
They like us and they give us a comment.
They leave us... You did none of that right. You leave us a review on iTunes.
I was just checking that you knew.
I say it at the end of every
show.
I'm
still furious by that thing that Milik, that whoever is the PR team, wrote that. Do you think they've ever watched a football match in their life?
We are happy to support Eric Millick and Napoli, said David Weiler, Tinder's Vice President of Partnerships. Tinder is first and foremost a platform for meeting people. We look forward to connecting fans with their favourite player. Millick has netted 8 times. I'm just reading the press release. Millick is not Napoli fans' favourite player. I think they like Insigne more, do they?
What, they claim he's the most favourite player? That's they've never been... No,
David Weiler! Yeah. Okay.
Surely Insigne, if not Mertens.
Chris, maybe it's because we're in long-term relationships. You're married now, I'm getting married. Tinder doesn't resonate with us, but maybe for other people.
No, I know. I'm not having a go at Tinder. That's, you know, fine. But Tinder and football and this sort of... Yeah. There's a lot of jargon that you dropped in there. Mm. Well, you didn't.
In innovative initiative.
Connect. Anyway, we're going on.
Okay, good. Okay, I hope you've enjoyed the show. We'll be back next Monday.
This is Football in Europe.